Please move with me to slide number 2. Today, the scientific consensus on global climate change is challenging our assumptions about water resources. Wetland habitats in particular are faced with unique challenges due to a number of factors, including rising sea levels and variable temperature and precipitation patterns. The importance of wetland functions and ecosystem services will continue to grow as the climate changes. Webcast instructors will discuss the issue from diverse perspectives, reflecting the multifaceted approach needed to address the problem. Join us to learn more about the latest research findings, effects on inland and coastal wetlands in Alaska and Maine, and collaborative planning efforts in the Hudson River Valley to build coalitions that support adaptation strategies to protect people and the environment. Before we meet our speakers, I would like to take a moment to point out that our webcasts are helping to reduce our global footprint by hosting these trainings in a virtual environment. Our first speaker is Dr. Virginia Burkett. Virginia is Chief Scientist of Global Change Research at the U.S. Geological Survey. In her capacity as Chief Scientist at USGS, Dr. Burkett has been a lead author on the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, Third and Fourth Assessment Reports, 2001 and 2007, and the forthcoming IPCC Technical Paper on Water, 2008. She formerly served as chief of the Forest Ecology Branch at the USGS National Wetlands Research Center and is the director of the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Our second speaker, Peter Slavinsky, is a coastal geologist with the Maine Geological Survey. At the Maine Geological Survey, Peter's focus has been on predicting potential impacts of coastal erosion and sea level rise. He was a NOAA Coastal Management Fellow and holds a MS in Geological Sciences from the University of South Carolina. When he's not in the field doing research, he can be found surfing Maine's cold waters. Our third speaker, Jim Powell, is the Water Quality Standards Section Manager at the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Jim has served as the Alaska State Wetlands Program Coordinator for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He has also been the Assistant Director for the Division of Environmental Quality, Special Assistant for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and Deputy Mayor, and an Assembly Member for the City and Borough of Juneau, Alaska. Our final speaker is David Van Leeuwen. David Van Leeuwen is the Hudson River Estuary Director for the Nature Conservancy, where he is leading Rising Waters, a collaborative planning effort to help Hudson Valley communities adapt to climate change. Throughout his career as an environmental advocate, David has connected good science with sound policy to achieve community-sensitive conservation. So, now that I've introduced our speakers, let's get started. Virginia, take it away.
Thank you, Megan. I'm going to start on slide 3 with the key messages, kind of the bottom line of the presentation today, which is a briefing about how wetlands are likely to be affected by aspects of climate that are changing and likely to intensify this century. And I'm not just going to be talking about water, but other aspects as well. Wetlands have been identified as some of the most vulnerable systems on most continents that are vulnerable to climate change impacts, in part because of the human development impacts that have already affected wetland systems. And I'll talk about the difficulties in projecting the precise outcomes of climate change on wetland systems because of interactions and threshold-type responses. I'll end with a discussion of adaptation and mitigation that can be employed to reduce adverse impacts on wetlands. Slide 4 shows some of we'll call it the lexicon of our uncertainty terms that we use in the various volumes and chapters of the IPCC reports, and even the U.S. government now in the CCSP is using a similar approach. So when I use terms like virtually likely, virtually certain, or likely, or high confidence, you'll know that we took very careful attention so that we were consistent across the IPCC reports. Slide 5, up in the upper right, you'll see a photo of the cover of the first volume by Working Group 1, which is the physical science basis of climate change. And some of the key findings here, that CO2 has increased about 30% since the 1850s, since the pre-industrial era, from 280 to 379 parts per million volume. Methane, the second most important long-lived greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, has more than doubled. And we've seen a slight cooling effect of aerosols, black carbon, nitrate, dust. If those weren't present in the atmosphere, there would have been even more warming than we've seen. And a lot of folks will say, well, you know, isn't the climate always changing? Yes, it is. And from the ice core records, we know that there are these large-scale oscillations that are driven by the Earth's orbital around the sun and the Earth's rotation on its axis that affects these blips in climate and these large oscillations. But we are confident that we have not seen this level of CO2 in the atmosphere for at least 650,000 years. Next slide, number 6, shows the past 100 years of temperature change globally from several thousand stations around the globe. The global average temperature increased 0.74 degrees C in 100 years, but 0.65 of that was in the past 50 years, and that's right at 1 degree Fahrenheit. And if you look at those lines that are in the graph, you can see that the rate of change for the 150-year record has basically ratcheted up for 100 years, 50 years in orange, and in yellow, the most recent few decades, the rate of change is much more than it was over the 150-year period. So it's intensifying in terms of the effects of temperature. Not only has there been temporal variation, there's also spatial variation. On slide 7, for example, you can see March, April, May up in the upper left, June, July, August, September, October, November. But look at December, January, February. The warming has been most intense this past century, and particularly the past three decades, at high latitudes and in the northern hemisphere and in North America in the winter months. And it is these relatively mild winters that structure ecosystems and their vegetation types and the plants, the animals that are found due to these mild winters. Basically, we've seen a northward expansion of ranges of species. In the next slide, we summarize some of the key findings about changes in hydrology. As the temperature of the atmosphere increases, the water vapor deficit, or the ability of the atmosphere to hold water, increases predictably, and so we've seen an increase in precipitation globally and across most of the northern hemisphere. At the same time, we've observed that the intensity of rainfall events has increased, but so did the number of dry days. So even though we've had more rainfall, it has come down in the form of these heavy rainfall events, and that coupled with the increase in temperature has led to an increase in drought potential. In addition, there's been observed globally, particularly in the northern hemisphere, less snow at low altitudes, earlier spring runoff, and a decline in mountain glaciers globally. The next slide, slide 9, talks about oceans, and as the temperature of the atmosphere increases, that heat energy is absorbed in the ocean, and we can detect that you can model it just precisely. It's doing exactly what would be expected, and is warming down to at least 300 meters in depth. And as the temperature of the sea surface increases, we've seen an increase in North Atlantic hurricane activity. There are many factors that influence the intensity of storms, but sea surface temperature is one of the main drivers. As the temperature of the ocean increases, the water expands. As you heat water, it expands. And the rate of sea level rise is increasing during the past century compared to the prior several hundred years. And during the past 15 years, since 1993, the instrumental record shows an acceleration in that rate of sea level rise. Now, IPCC does not say this is due to human activity. It may just be natural variability. There's just not a long enough temperature record using satellite altimetry since 1993. But you can look at that graphic at the bottom of slide 9, and you can see a huge geographic variability in the rate of sea level rise. So if you manage coastal wetlands, don't just look at the global rate of 1.7 millimeters per year. Look at the rate actually occurring off of your coastline. The next slide looks at future changes in the physical climate system. Warming is expected to be about 0.4 degrees Celsius during the next 20 years. And remember, we had 0.65 during the last 50 years. So the rate of warming continuing to increase exponentially through time. Again, greatest over land and at high latitudes in the northern hemisphere. And if greenhouse gas emissions continue, the changes will be very likely larger than we've seen so far. the next page, page 11 in the slides, just shows a graphical representation from the IPCC report of the spatial variability of these variables. The precipitation, you know, if you manage wetlands out in the southwestern region, look at the changes in precipitation and soil moisture and in runoff. And, you know, they portend tremendous changes in stream flow and water availability for wetlands and other conservation uses. The next slide, number 12, shows the projections using all of the IPCC models. There's about 21 models that are used by IPCC from various experiments conducted globally. And the top line in the orange and yellow shows the temperature response, the annual temperature change, but look at the winter temperatures. Higher the latitude, the more intense the change. And so, you know, looking again at this continued intense increase in these winter temperatures that will affect vegetation types. Along the bottom, you see the precipitation changes that are projected by the end of this century compared to what the average precipitation was between 1980 and 1999. And you can see drying generally in the southern end of the region of the northern hemisphere, the North America, and a wetter environment the higher the latitude you go. The next slide shifts to some of the impacts that are described in Working Group 2. Basically, we've seen very high confidence that we've seen changes on all continents and in some oceans that are we can attribute to climate change, particularly temperature change. Likely that a discernible influence has been seen in many physical and biological systems. And globally, 20 to 30% of species will be at increasingly high risk of extinction by 2100, with a warming of 2 to 3 degrees above pre-industrial levels. And remember, we're 0.7 degrees there already. Another key message here, freshwater ecosystems will have the highest proportion of species threatened with extinction due to climate change, according to IPCC. The last sentence there, if you're a wetland manager, and I've been one before myself, and this sentence struck me. Current conservation practices are generally poorly prepared to adapt to this level of change. In wetland systems particularly, we're all keenly aware of the importance of hydrology and that being the primary determinant of where wetlands occur and of their ecological functions and of the structure of wetlands. A very small part of the acreage, aerial extent of the United States, large, almost half of Alaska is wetland. And then if you look in the lower 48, you can see the distribution of wetlands in that technical paper that our folks produced. And on the next slide, important point that over half of the wetlands in the lower 48 states have been lost since 1980. Most of the wetland losses are attributable to agricultural practices. That slide there showing the agricultural lands in the Mississippi Valley I took a few years ago in one of our restoration plots where we were doing some experiments. And if you look in the map of the pre-industrial forest cover there, you can see that compared to the land cover map in the lower graphic shows just a tremendous loss of wetlands along the Atlantic coastal plain and in the Mississippi Valley. Half of these losses were in wetland forest, and most occurred in the southeastern region. Slide 16 just will start to walk you through some of the key variables that are climate-related that will likely affect wetland systems, either directly or indirectly. Elevated CO2 has a direct effect on plant growth. You know, we know it affects the temperature, but we also know that it has a direct fertilization effect on the growth of plants. But not all plants respond the same to the CO2 enrichment. C3 plants, plants that use the C3 pathway, photosynthetic pathway, respond greater or faster and more effectively to CO2 enrichment than do C4 plants. So the competition among plants will be affected by the CO2 enrichment itself. In the next slide, you can also see that CO2 levels will affect dissolved CO2 in waters, in coastal waters and in inland waters, which enhances the growth of submerged aquatic vegetation, like the seagrass bed there in the lower left, but it also enhances algal growth. So the increase in CO2 may actually contribute to more frequent algal blooms in coastal and inland waters. In slide 18, we've kind of got a summary here of some of the primary drivers that I've talked about, all of these so far, and the effects on wetlands and aquatic systems. Temperature affects runoff, water quality, soil moisture. In water quality, I mean like dissolved oxygen availability. It also affects plant community structure, but these interact with each other, and so the effects and the ultimate outcomes in wetland systems vary from one wetland to another and from one region to another, depending upon the intensity of climate change. The last few slides here give you examples of wetland impacts. I'll try to get some geographic examples here to give you some distribution around the country. Increasing temperatures and drought lead to more intense drying or permanent loss of ephemeral streams and vernal pool wetlands or seasonal wetlands, particularly out west. Lower soil moisture leads to more intense, frequent, and widespread fires. You know, this past few days they've been dealing with fires in Florida. But in the coastal marshes even, if the droughts continue to increase in intensity, and we have more productivity and more litter fall due to the CO2 enrichment, then there are likely to be these more intense and frequent and widespread fires. In the Alaskan tundra, for example, tremendous loss of organic matter and collapse of ecosystems there due to widespread fires associated with drought. Next slide, number 21, example of these higher temperatures in Alaska having another sort of permutation on wetlands. As the permafrost thaws, Alaskan wetlands are forming these polygons, our refuge managers up there say, where the landscape is breaking up into these, look like puzzle pieces, and the water is draining out basically as the permafrost thaws. In addition, many of the Alaskan lakes are drying out very rapidly, and we have several publications that just present some stunning results of monitoring of the extent of Alaskan lakes. Slide 4 shows how sea level rise and more intense storms are likely to affect, or an illustration of how it might affect coastal erosion. During Hurricane Katrina overnight, Louisiana lost 217 square miles of its coast due to the passage of the hurricane. The Chandelier Island chain there on the right protects the city of New Orleans and those Breton Sound marshes from storm surge, and they were reduced in aerial extent by 85% by Hurricane Katrina. Next slide, adaptation strategies themselves can adversely affect wetlands and coastal systems. By building dams to provide water supply as the climate changes, wetlands can be impacted. Shoring up coastal features can affect coastal wetlands as you build dikes and levees. And saltwater intrusion, I haven't mentioned yet, but as sea level rises, the salinity of coastal wetlands will increase. And so these freshwater forests, like the one shown there on the left, that's a bald cypress tree. You know, it's getting saltier, and so these trees are dying off, and that's the Homosassa River area in Florida where we've had a die-off of coastal forests due to saltwater intrusion. And many, on the next slide, number 24, another example of impacts is not just on wetland plants and the water, but also on the species that inhabit them, particularly endangered species, with a huge percentage of U.S. endangered species are wetland-dependent. Like the Everglades there, we've got these four main species of concern, the kite, the wood stork, the spoonbill, and the Cape Sable seaside sparrow on the left. And if you look at the next slide, it shows how the interaction of these various drivers affects the physical systems in South Florida. So you really need to understand the processes that are at work, what created the wetlands, what types of changes are anticipated in the future, and then be able to assess the ultimate outcomes on structures, plant community structure, rather. And the implications for restoration and management in the Everglades are fairly apparent on the next slide, and there's a report there you can download. We've cited at the bottom of slide 26. And my last slide, what can be done to reduce impacts? Well, it's obvious that a combination of mitigation and adaptation can reduce the effects on wetlands and other natural systems. By mitigation, we refer to reducing greenhouse gas emissions or enhancing carbon sinks. And wetlands are nature's way of laying down carbon for the long term. So restoring wetlands and protecting wetlands can affect the concentration of greenhouse gases. And finally, that adaptation word, which is purposeful steps that are taken to adapt management strategies, water uses, and so forth to allow natural systems to persist as the climate changes. And with that, Megan, I'll turn it back over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. We will pause briefly here to take some questions. Let's begin with those submitted online. Just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on that question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from Paul in D.C., and Paul asks, since we are generally poorly prepared to adapt to this level of change, which climate-related variables might wetlands managers be the most concerned about or put the most resources?
Water. That's my response. The availability of water. The farming community, the industrial community, municipalities are all concerned about water. Even in the southeast, or in Atlanta, that was a real good example of the types of conflicts over water that are likely to occur during the coming decades. So positioning yourself as a wetland manager to provide water to the wetlands, and be there at the table as decisions are made about the water and its delivery and its allocation, I'd say that would be the number one priority that I would suggest.
Thank you. Our second question comes from Catherine in Maryland. Catherine asks, given wetlands protection resource limitations and the agony of choice, should we focus our conservation efforts on areas with the most wetlands, Alaska, the Southeast, or areas at the highest risk, e.g. Southwest?
Catherine, that is a wonderful question. I think it depends upon your values, your what society would want in your particular state. As a scientist, I really don't advocate the course of action that would be taken. You know, my preference in having led conservation programs for one state would be to pursue both the conservation of where you have wetlands at highest risk and where you have endangered species, for example, and at the same time where you have the greatest concentration of wetlands that can provide those services that are important to society. So the answer would be both, but it will depend locally and at state level and federally, even for folks here at EPA, to set those priorities.
And our next question comes from Rachel in Virginia. Thank you for sharing the IPCC models with us, particularly of projected future changes with regard to precipitation, soil moisture, runoff, evaporation, and temperature. What advice can you give wetland managers on regional, state, or even local levels, given the large scale of the models you described?
I think in the toolbox that you have, monitoring has become even more important, given the changes that we're experiencing and are likely to intensify this century. So placing an emphasis on monitoring and adapting your management strategies so that you can basically minimize the effects. So adaptive management, I know as it's talked about, there's handbooks that are on the shelf that I think that we haven't pulled off as frequently as are needed and will be needed during the next few decades. But you're right that these global changes, there's nothing you can do to change these changes in precipitation and temperature that are anticipated. Even if emissions were stabilized at present level, we would still be experiencing for the next 4 to 5 decades changes in temperature and precipitation due to the changes that have already been made in the atmosphere. So preparing for those, monitoring their effects, and adapting your management is probably the first order of business. Thanks.
And our next question comes from Sandy in Ohio. And Sandy would like to know, how will the Great Lakes region be affected?
Sandy, unfortunately, I have not written anything about the Great Lakes, and this is one area where I'm going to get your email address.
You have that?
Okay, they have your email address, and I'm going to send you some links to some publications that will help you for the Great Lakes. We also have a Great Lakes Science Center there in Madison that can... Dr. Doug Wilcox, who is the editor of the journal Wetlands, and he is an expert on Great Lakes wetlands, and I will refer him to you as well. So we'll follow up with you on that.
At this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question. Just as a reminder, please make sure that you are muted if you're not asking a question, as it makes it hard to hear. Are there any questions?
In Region 1, we do have a question, EPA Region 1.
Go ahead.
Hi, I was wondering if we need to speak about what the most effective adaptation techniques would be at this point in time.
Background is more in coastal wetlands, and restoring natural sedimentary processes that created the present coast is important. All of the coast, all of the major deltas and the coasts that are presently existing globally were formed during the past 7,000 years when sea level was relatively stable. And there are, in Texas, for example, more than 90% of the surface waters are dammed, and so the sediment cannot get to the coast. In Louisiana, we've levied the river, basically piping all that freshwater and sediment offshore, so we have a sediment-starved, freshwater-starved, and rapidly deteriorating coast. So in the coastal zone, there are many, many options. In our IPCC chapter, we have devoted pages to potential adaptation strategies in coastal systems. For inland systems, there's a wider range of options that would be need to be considered, depending upon the hydrology, the types of wetlands, because they're much more diverse. But for a starting point, I'd look at the IPCC report and get some examples from there on your interior wetlands.
Thank you, Virginia. Are there any other questions from the phone lines?
Yes, I'm wondering if you have any data on the comparative carbon.
Comparative carbon?
Carbon in wetlands versus other vegetation types, and comparison of wetlands for carbon sequestration versus in situ deposits of carbon, terrestrial carbon sequestration.
Okay, first, and one more thing came to me from the last question. Another thing that is very obvious is the importance of reducing other stressors on wetlands. And I should have mentioned that as probably the most logical thing, the no regrets option, but that should be right there in that list of potential adaptations. In terms of wetlands and carbon, there's a State of the Carbon report, and there are many publications that can give you a feel for the value of wetlands in terms of their ability to sequester carbon. Again, there's a lot of geographic variability, and as wetlands are drained, they can produce CO2 and methane. So I don't have a single answer for you of their relative value. We do have numbers. The Department of Agriculture, actually, a guy named Bill Hohenstein has some numbers. And if we can get your web address, your email address, we'll give you his report that has that number.
And are there any other questions from the fans? Okay, at this time we will move on to our second speaker. So, Peter, if you would like to go ahead and unmute yourself and take it away.
Thanks, Megan. Virginia touched on a very good issue, aside from all the wonderful data that she provided, that coastal wetlands are some of the most susceptible to human development. And I use the word resiliency in my title, because resilience is really the ability to recover from or adapt to misfortune and change. And coastal wetlands, unfortunately, have had to be extremely resilient in response to human activity in the past. And in response to projected sea level rise levels, we're trying to look at how resilient not only can communities be, but how resilient can wetlands be in response to sea level rise. The goal of the project that I'm going to be sharing with you, not only am I going to delve into potential impacts of sea level rise on coastal wetlands within Maine itself, but I'm going to share with you tools, data, and the process that we're going through in engaging coastal municipalities on developing resilience and planning for sea level rise impacts on both development and coastal wetlands. If you go to slide 30, how are we really going to achieve the goal of developing resiliency for both our wetlands and our coastal communities? There's really a three-step process that we're going through. There are three agencies that are working on the program right now: the Maine Coastal Program, the Maine Geological Survey, who I'm with, and the Southern Maine Regional Planning Commission, which is a regional planning commission which kind of bridges between the state agencies and several towns. We're working with towns within Saco Bay in Maine, which I'm going to go on in a second, with the town of Scarborough, Old Orchard Beach, Saco, and Bidford. And each of these communities are very diverse in terms of not only their development patterns, but how they've been managing wetlands in the past. So we're currently in an outreach phase, and we're working on partnership development and education with the goal of really providing data and tools to these communities so that they can understand, review, provide feedback on resiliency, and implement plans that address vulnerability and develop resiliency patterns for their communities and for their coastal wetlands. Slide 31 gives you kind of a geographic location of where we are. On the left-hand side is the state of Maine, all the way up in the northeast corner of the country. We're the first ones to see the sun during the day. That's our claim to fame. In a little black circle there is Saco Bay, and on the right-hand side of slide 31 is an aerial image showing the rough study area that I'm going to be sharing with you today. From north to south is the communities of Scarborough, Old Orchard Beach, Saco, and Bidford. And one thing to point out is Saco Bay is our largest expanse of sandy beaches in the state of Maine, about 7 miles. And in conjunction with that, it's also our largest expanse of coastal wetlands. Each of these communities, like I said, is very diverse in terms of the development patterns that they sustain. And we're going to focus on three little pilot areas within each of these. In the northern corner is Pine Point in Scarborough. And then we're going to touch on Ocean Park, which is in Old Orchard Beach. And then Saco, which is in the southern part of the study area. Next slide, slide 32. So part of our education phase of the whole project in developing resiliency amongst these communities is to provide them with different data and tools that the Maine Geological Survey and the other programs have developed. There are a variety of assessment tools that we have been working on in the last 6 years, everything from regulatory GIS coverages of erosion hazard areas and coastal sand dune boundaries, which is the way we regulate our coastline, to providing LIDAR, light detection and ranging topographic data. But what really is applicable to today's discussion is what we're doing in terms of trying to inform these communities on sea level rise and inundation, and how it relates to coastal wetlands and also the communities themselves. Next slide, slide 33. When we talk about sea level rise in Maine, if you go back about 13,000 years, sea level was actually about 70 meters above present, and that really relates to the relative sea level in Maine. Maine was actually under about a mile of ice about 13,000 years ago, and in about 2,000 years, all that ice melted, and sea level actually dropped to about 60 meters below present. And that was because of isostatic rebound, or landmass rebounding, kind of like a Tempur-Pedic mattress does when you lift your hand up off of it. But in about the last 3,000 to 5,000 years, our relative sea level rise change isn't really the driving factor behind what's happening anymore. It's global sea level rise that's happening. And what I'm showing you in this image on slide 33 is since 1912, I mean, we've been measuring tidal levels in Portland, Maine. And the overall regressive line through that is about 1.8 millimeters a year. And Virginia shared with us a global change earlier, which is about 1.8 millimeters a year as well. So the changes we're seeing in the last 100 years are about equal to what's happening in the global ocean. Slide 34, very quickly, a summary of sea level rise in Maine. In about the last 3,000 years, we're actually looking at the highest rate of sea level rise along our coast. When the majority of our coastal wetlands and beaches formed in the last 3,000 to 5,000 years, sea level rise was a little bit over 1 millimeter per year. And Virginia shared with us that satellite altimetry is showing that sea level could be rising at about 3.1 millimeters per year, which is almost twice what the global rate is now. Next slide, please. So how is Maine trying to adapt to potential sea level rise? Well, our coastal sand dune rules, which regulate the open ocean coast and what happens along that coastline, has opted to plan for 2 feet of sea level rise over the next 100 years. And that's roughly a middle-of-the-road prediction. But one thing that we could do better is we could look at the potential impacts of sea level rise on coastal wetlands. Within Maine, we actually have a regulatory definition of what a coastal wetland is. Next slide, please, 36. And coastal wetlands means all tidal and subtidal lands, all areas with vegetation present that is tolerant of salt water. And you can read the rest of the definition for yourselves. But the key here is that it's areas subject to tidal action during the highest tide level for each year. And that's based on National Ocean Service tide tables and tide charts. So in looking at coastal wetlands, for this project, we wanted to try to take a look at what the impact of 2 feet of sea level rise could be on our existing coastal wetlands. Next slide, please. Slide 37 shows you a geographic image of Saco Bay kind of laid on its side, with north being to the left-hand side. And we're going to focus on the first pilot study area, which is Pine Point and Scarborough. Next slide, please, 38. This image that I'm showing you here is simply an ortho-rectified aerial photograph of Pine Point and Scarborough, and you can see on the upper right-hand corner a thoroughfare coming through for cars to travel on, and you can also see some channels from a tidal marsh. What I've done here is I've actually overlaid LIDAR topographic data and color-coded it just to show you that not only can you pick out the defining boundary between the upper marsh or the high marsh and the low marsh based on the orthophotograph, but when you overlay the topography, you can also see it. And the black arrows are kind of pointing towards the subtle difference between the light blues and the dark blues. This LIDAR data, or the topographic light detection and ranging data, is the basis for our sea level rise scenarios. If you forward on to slide 39, this image is showing how we're characterizing our different wetland areas. What we've found is that the dark blue areas are basically what we're calling open water, OW, and that's basically everything at or below mean sea level. The lighter blue, the middle blue, I guess you could call it, is what we're calling mean high water. And areas built between open water and mean high water typically characterize our low marsh habitats, so dominated by Spartina alterniflora. In terms of our high marsh habitat, that's between mean high water and highest annual tide, or HAT. And if you look at those black arrows again, you can pretty much see that boundary between high marsh, which is dominated by Spartina patens, and low marsh, is pretty well defined. So using these different tidal elevations are good proxies for how marshes could potentially change after you add the role of sea level rise. On slide 40, I'm showing what happens after we add 2 feet of projected sea level rise to the marsh systems. First thing you'll notice is that the whole slide is covered in basically the mid-blue. And that is because what we're finding is that there's so much anthropogenic influence on the marsh through developed uplands, diked uplands, bulkheaded uplands, that our high marsh is at capacity, and when you add sea level rise to it, there's no room for our high marshes to transgress. There is room for the low marsh to transgress, but not room for the high marsh. Slide 41, please. This is showing the second area I'm going to share with you called Ocean Park and Old Orchard Beach. Old Orchard Beach is a destination tourist community, but Ocean Park itself is fairly residential. And there's an interesting problem associated with this area. Slide 42, please. This slide shows the area of Ocean Park that was highlighted. On your right-hand side is a small tidal brook called Goosefair Brook, and coastal wetlands associated with that, from low marsh to high marsh, in the light blue to the very light blue. The red arrow is pointing to a tide gate, which allows flow underneath the roadway, and then the black arrows are actually pointing towards ditches, and you can actually see that the tidal flow is ditched under three or four streets and then reemerges. The black box is showing an area of historically, the limits of the highest annual tide are the limits of the high marsh. Now, this area is so restricted from tidal flow right now that only about a third of that area is actually high marsh dominated. The rest is actually freshwater dominated. So one thing we're exploring as part of this process is if tidal restrictions are lifted and tide gates are installed that allow full flow into this area, what would happen in response to the marsh and what would happen in response to potential flooding in the community? Going on to slide 43, you can see that there would be a dramatic impact on not only the marsh systems, but also potential flooding for the entire community. Areas of high marsh would likely turn into areas of low marsh and areas that are not developed, and areas that are developed would likely be flooded under both mean high water and highest annual tide conditions. And most importantly, emergency access along one of those roadways would be compromised. Next slide, please. So what we wanted to get across to these communities by showing them some of this data is that the topographic data that we're using, the images, can really be used to simulate the impacts of sea level rise and how communities are going to respond in terms of managing tidal restrictions, focusing on restoration and conservation of coastal wetlands. In terms of development siting, they should be looking at areas that aren't fully developed already in terms of allowing marsh transgression to occur so that that high marsh area does have an area of upland to transgress into if it's not already developed, and of course the impacts to habitats. Next slide, 45, is showing an area called Camp Ellis in Saco, at the southern end of Saco Bay. It's adjacent to the Saco River, which provides all the sediment to the bay. Its southern boundary is a long 6,000-foot jetty. And unfortunately, Camp Ellis is notorious for having the highest erosion rate in Maine and suffers the worst northeasters in Maine. Next slide, 46, please. This is a close-up image of the study area with north being pointed to the north, up on the screen. And you can see that this is outlining existing conditions in terms of marsh habitats and also existing flood issues, and there really are none. Again, you can notice that the marsh system here is dominated by high marsh, especially on the left-hand side of the screen, with areas of low marsh as well. If you forward down to slide 47, that actually shows the impacts of 2 feet of sea level rise on not only the marsh areas. Again, you lose a lot of the high marsh area and it's overtaken by low marsh, but the red arrows are pointing to areas that we expected to be flooded under highest annual tide conditions plus 2 feet of sea level rise. Now, what was interesting is that we did this scenario, this simulation, prior to the Patriots Day storm of 2007, which was a pretty big event up here. The storm surge was about 2.5 feet NAVD, North American Vertical Datum. Our simulation of highest annual tide plus 2 feet was about 2.4 feet NAVD. So it was kind of a simulation of what could have occurred on the Patriots Day storm. As it turns out, it's what did occur on the Patriots Day storm. The upper left arrow is going to show a photograph looking to the southwest, while the lower arrow is going to show a figure pointing to the east. Next slide, please. So this is looking to the southwest along a floodway that kind of popped up during the Patriots Day storm. So is this what we're looking at under highest annual tide conditions for the future? This area that you're looking at behind the boat is where the coastal wetlands actually exist. So should this area be allowed to transgress in a landward direction? Unfortunately, this area right now is slated for multi-million dollar condo development and marina development. So there's conflicting interests, of course. There are almost in everything we choose to do. Next slide down, 49, shows the image to the east along a roadway in Camp Ellis, and this is a fairly major road that runs east to west and provides access to the jetty that you can see in the background. So, and this is about 2 feet of water that are on the roadway here. So, again, are we looking at these kind of conditions under each highest annual tide of every year? Moving on to slide 50. So where are we in this whole project process of providing data to communities and really focusing on developing resiliency in terms of the communities and how they're going to deal with all these different hazards, especially in the case of what we're sharing today, impacts to coastal wetlands? Well, we're only at the red part, the introduction of concepts. It's going to take some buy-in from these communities to really get on board with trying to do some of the things that we'd like them to do. And during this process, we're asking that they provide feedback so that when we share the data that we've developed with them, how can we improve it? Is there other data that they need? And with that, we want to work with the communities to identify adaptation strategies or mitigation strategies that would be effective in dealing with hazard vulnerabilities and the impact of sea level rise on coastal wetlands. The overall goal of the project is to have these communities adopt strategies into their comprehensive plans and ordinances so that they leave space adjacent to existing tidal marshes so that marshes can transgress. This is a multi-year project. We're only doing a pilot project with these four communities. We'd like to share it with other communities after this. We'll see how it goes before we commit to that, but that's where we are right now. Slide 51, this is the last slide, kind of gives some of the postulated strategies from the state and municipal level that we are kind of hoping we could go down. From a state level, what we'd really like to do is use some of the data and tools that we've developed to change the regulatory definition to include a future coastal wetland. And with that, then have state-funded programs that focus acquisition for marsh conservation and restoration programs so that undeveloped areas adjacent to some of these marshes can function in a natural way in response to sea level rise. And from the municipal level, one thing we've been trying to focus on for the communities is to get them to work in a coordinated fashion to address hazard sea level rise and wetlands management. These factors, especially wetlands management and hazards and sea level rise, they don't see geopolitical boundaries. Communities, unfortunately, do. So what we're trying to do is really get these communities to think on a regional level, not just a municipal level, but a regional level in terms of land use and development planning, or stormwater and road infrastructure management. How is runoff from a road or stormwater runoff going to impact another community or the adjacent coastal wetland? And through all of these municipal level strategies, we're really, really hoping that we can work with these communities to ensure that not only the communities remain resilient, but also our coastal wetlands can remain resilient in the future. And that does it. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter. If I could please get everyone to move with me to slide number 52. We will pause briefly here to take some questions, and we'll begin with those submitted online. Just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on that question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from Dave in Iowa. Maine is planning for 2 feet of sea level rise. What if projections change and the middle of the road projection increases substantially? What planning capacity or processes exist to accommodate new scientific realities?
Wow, Dave, that's a very good question. Our adoption of 2 feet of sea level rise kind of coincided with a revision of our coastal sand dune rules, which govern development along the open beach systems in Maine. And that occurred in a period between 2003, really, and 2006. It was a multi-year process with many, many, many stakeholders, including state agencies, local consultants, and private property owners groups. It was a contentious process at times, and took quite a bit of time. Adapting to different projections in sea level rise may have to undergo the same process. And this was a process we went through because basically the Maine legislature said, you folks need to sit down and figure out what you're going to go on. So we took the best available science at the times, which was the IPCC projections in addition to what we were measuring in the state of Maine, and we adapted and shot for 2 feet because basically we're looking at about 1.6 feet when you combine everything. So that's where we were. How we're going to do it in the future, right now I'm not sure how to answer that question, aside from we'd probably have to go through a similar process.
Thank you, Peter. Our next question comes from Joe in West Virginia. If tidal restrictions are lifted and marsh systems restored, how will the invasive plant systems respond that you mentioned dominate now?
Good question. As an example, we're somewhat lucky in Maine in that we don't have a huge abundance of Phragmites australis, the common weed, which really in some of the mid-Atlantic and southern, southeastern states has really, really begun to overtake a lot of the marsh areas. It just as an example, the wetland area in Ocean Park that I was talking about that currently is freshwater dominated. For instance, that goes from high marsh to dead cattails to cattails, which actually are not an invasive species. What we are hoping is that the influx of the salty water when we restore the tidal flow in that area will allow for the natural growth of high marsh. And one thing that I didn't point out is that Maine is dominated by high marsh, actually. And in our scenarios, there's been, after 2 feet of sea level rise, we would actually see a 40 to 45% decrease in high marsh and almost 100 to 150% growth in low marsh. There are a lot of factors that come into the question that you have, especially with nutrient loading from uplands that can be influencing some of the invasives that actually grow, along with what some folks plant in the adjacent uplands and how those species are going to be adaptable to some of the influx of salt water as we see sea level rise.
Thank you. We do have time for one question from the phone line, so if you do have a question from the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question. Are there any questions?
Hello, this is Peter Weisbuch from USGS in Massachusetts.
Go ahead.
I'd like to ask our Maine colleague whether there's been any consideration of the effects of sea level rise on coastal groundwater levels and whether areas that are now, for example, feasible for the use of septic systems will in the future potentially become uninhabitable because of groundwater levels increasing.
Peter, that's a great question, and in response, we haven't really been considering it at this point. A lot of our coastal communities have switched over to sewered water, but there are areas that still use septic. And from a groundwater standpoint, and not only that, but also an aquifer standpoint, I think one of the big issues is going to be, the salt water penetrating some of these groundwater drinking the aquifers as well, the drinking aquifers, sorry, not thinking clearly at the moment. But no, we really are not doing anything with that at all at the current time.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. And at this time, if I could please get everyone to move with me to slide number 53, I'd like to take a moment to tell you about our next webcast. The Watershed Academy's next webcast will be on June 18th from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern. This webcast will focus on the new Water Quality Assessment and Total Maximum Daily Loads Information, or if you'd like the simple version, ATTAINS database. ATTAINS is an online tool that provides information reported by the states to EPA about the conditions of their surface waters. Please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcast, that's all one word, for more information about this webcast. All right, at this time we will move on to our next section of today's presentation. Jim, take it away. Jim, if you could go ahead and unmute yourself.
Thank you for inviting me to speak. I want to commend the organizers at EPA for holding this teleconference. It's not easy to pull together a teleconference, especially with multiple presentations. My presentation stands on the shoulders of at least three noteworthy researchers at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, so I'd like to mention them real briefly. Professor of Ecology, Terry Chapin, and also the head of the International Arctic Research Center, Larry Hinsman, and Professor Katie Walter. They're doing great work and contributing to our understanding of wetlands and global ecological changes. Please note at the end of all of our presentations for references and other material. Turning to my presentation, the objective of my presentation is to describe some of the research and observable effects of climate change in Alaska and to our communities. I hope to also leave you with some images of what Alaskans are doing on the ground to address climate change, which is here and now and upon us. My first slide, number 54, outlines my presentation. There are six parts. First, I will quickly give Alaskan context and facts about climate change in the north. Second, I want to highlight some key changes to hydrology, ecology caused by climate change. Third, I'll be touching on some specific changes observed, including wetlands and northern lakes and wildfire. Last, I want to discuss some of the effects and changes or adaptations communities are making and make some suggestions on dealing with climate change. Slide 55. There are two primary reasons why Alaska is part of the discussion on wetlands and climate change. First, wetlands are a dominant landform in Alaska, and about 40% of Alaska is classified as wetlands. This accounts for 60% of the U.S. total wetland ecosystems. We are learning that the vast acreage, and specifically the functions performed by these wetlands, are rapidly changing. Specifically, most wetlands in Alaska, or in the north, are predicted to dry up in the 21st century. The map to the right side of slide 55 shows a distribution of the increase in the average annual temperature change through Alaska from 1949 to 2005. The changes range from 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit to 1.7 degrees. For example, in my hometown, which is in southeast Alaska, not subarctic or arctic, but coastal, my hometown of Juneau has experienced a 3.8 degree change over that same time period. Other changes happening in Alaska, air temperature increasing by 0.4 degrees per decade, and the growing season increasing by 2.6 days. Some people may consider that a positive effect, especially if you live in Alaska. Another change is that the thawing of permafrost in interior Alaska is accelerating, and this is happening particularly along lake margins. Finally, I will highlight later in the presentation the frequency, duration, and temperature of wildfire and boreal forested wetlands and uplands and rising. Slide 56. This slide shows regional and global temperature change. As you will see, Alaska is pretty much covered in dark red. The darkest red is located over interior and central Alaska and western Canada and indicates an increase of 8 degrees in winter temperatures during the last 60 years. It's no wonder we in Alaska say we burn first. Slide 57, permafrost distributions. As you may know, permafrost is classified as a wetland, and most of Alaskan wetlands are permafrost. This slide shows the distribution of permafrost. And there's different types. Continuous permafrost is in blue, discontinuous permafrost is in purple, and sporadic and isolated are in pink colors. As you can see, permafrost is the dominant landform in these northern areas. Also, lakes have a large distribution in the north. Recent research has shown that the edges of lakes are contributing 5 times more methane to the atmosphere than originally thought. That's huge. Lakes in the north are being looked at seriously because of the effect of methane on climate change. Slide 58. Now we'll move to discuss at least two key shifts that are observable in northern wetlands caused by increased temperatures. These shifts are changes I characterize under hydrologic and ecological functions. Although lakes and wetlands in the north naturally develop and disappear as natural processes, we now can observe changes caused by increased temperatures and precipitation. A little about permafrost. Permafrost wetlands have soils largely consisting of peat soils perched on frozen ice lenses, which lock up water and sequester carbon, largely due to low temperatures. Temperatures are rising rapidly in the north and are drying up some types of wetlands. Interior Alaska and Canada already have low precipitation and expect only modest, if any, increases in precipitation as climate change moves forward. Warmer temperatures are anticipated to cause hydrologic shifts not yet seen and some seen. Warmer temperatures are anticipated to cause these shifts. Whether permafrost becomes drier or wetter caused by the thawing of frozen peat is largely dependent upon local and regional hydrology. Both changes will have profound and uncertain effects on the ecology of interior Alaska. Drying up may have cascading effects from vegetative changes, and we're already seeing that, measuring that, impacts to wildlife, caribou migrations and subsistence harvesting, for example, for those that live in rural Alaska. And when permafrost dries, it will cause damage to roads and infrastructure. In fact, basic assumptions about building and maintaining roads will need to change due to rapid changes in the permafrost. Some of the most startling and interesting research has centered on the discovery of the edges of lakes, which I previously mentioned, that has occurred in northern Siberia and northern Alaska, about the thawing and the consequences of warming temperatures and the release of much more methane than we previously thought. Slide 59. Wetland ecology and change, climate change. As mentioned, some wetlands are drying in lowlands, and pools are created in those areas, and uplands are enlarging due to the drying and decreasing percentage of permafrost. The big unknown is how will the ecological web change? We do not know. However, we are certain that wetland ecology is changing. Researchers have observed pieces of the ecological puzzle and are beginning to regionalize and localize climate models, those GMCs, those large global models, and their effects. We know only pieces of the changing ecology. Another big question pertinent to watershed concerns is the expectation that regional water tables may lower. This will have dramatic effects for humans and all parts of the ecological system. Slide 60. Moving to a few ecological changes. Due to drying up, some wetlands, particularly forested black spruce wetlands in interior Alaska, we have become more vulnerable to forest fires. Forest fires have become more frequent, hotter, and have longer duration. Also, bark beetle outbreaks, insect outbreaks are occurring more often. In Alaska, there are millions of acres of black spruce forested wetlands that have burned. The wildfires burn the surface of the vegetation and in turn expose the tundra and cause the permafrost to thaw at an even more rapid rate. Slide 61. The next two slides focus on lake edge wetlands. The reason lakes are discussed is because of the relatively recent discovery. The edge of the lakes account for a large amount of the global methane, as shown in the pie chart to the right and below. The edges of lakes provide a rich habitat for methane-producing bacteria that during decomposition of organic material. Large lakes are increasing in size on continuous permafrost. The more north you go, the more pooling. The more south you go in Alaska, the more drying up. Researchers are still gathering more local, regional, and soon statewide data. It's a huge state. Slide 62. Wetlands and lakes in the north are a dominant landscape feature. Up to 48% of the land surface, again. In the last few years, studies at UAF, University of Alaska Fairbanks, and others have discovered just how important they are. This could have, the changes in that ecology, the change in the size of lakes, the distribution, could have a huge impact on migratory wildlife, resident wildlife, not to mention the people that depend on these resources for food and culture. The same process that allow initiation or drying of the ponds may also cause increases or decreases in soil moisture, with significant impacts to heat fluxes potentially affecting regional climate change. As a note, a recent observation on April 16th of this year, climate change and resultant fluctuation in precipitation is believed to cause the increase in snowpack leading to a major avalanche south of Juneau, my hometown. The avalanche took down transmission towers and a 1.5 mile of power line and left 30,000 residents in Juneau without 95% of its power, which is hydropower. This forced us to run on 100% diesel, increasing electrical bills by 450% for the next 3 months. These are the kind of changes that you may see. Lots of surprises. Also, lakes used to generate hydropower are fluctuating more, and operators of those hydropower plants are having a difficult time predicting how much is needed from month to month. Slide 63. One of the main impacts of climate change in Alaska so far is on forest health, as I mentioned, fires. On the Kenai Peninsula, also, there has been, was, a large forest insect infestation to occur. It was the largest in North America, the spruce bark beetle, which devastated millions of acres. Wildfire is increasing in Alaska. Normally, wildfires burn 1/2 to 1.5 million acres per year. Wildfires caused by lightning and dry conditions. Normally, wildfires burn uplands, but many fires are also on interior wetlands and permafrost. In 2004, new records were set for Alaskan wildfires. 600 fires burned in 2004, caused by an unusually hot weather. This topped the previous record held in 1957. This may signal possible changes in climate conditions and the composition of the vast forests. Forests and landscapes that include wetlands have changed. Slide 64. Ecological processes caused by hotter and larger and more frequent fires, the distribution has doubled since 1970 and will change ecological processes. Changes in vegetation are now occurring. I will move to slide 65. Moving to the edge effect, wetlands and boreal forest wetlands, this slide shows coastal erosion happening right now and outlines what is predicted within the next few years. Although my task is to discuss interior wetlands, I wanted to show these slides because they're dramatic and they're happening now. The bottom line is that coastal communities have to move. Slide 66. This is a picture of the coast of where Shishmaref, the community of Shishmaref, is, and they have to move. In the past 30 years, the coastline in northwestern Alaska has moved inland 100 to 300 feet. Six communities in particular have begun to move or are planning to move. Warmer temperatures has caused protective ice allowing to melt and allowing waves to pound and erode the coast. Slide 67.
Jim, if I could just interject for 1 second, if you could just speed up a little bit, we're kind of running short on time.
Okay, well, I'll move to the punchline, which is I'd like to move, to slide 70, if we can move to slide 70, right to adaptation and resilience, because I think that might be of most interest to the people on the phone. Adaptation. And I'm going to go to the punchline on that. Last night, I met with consultants and locals from Shishmaref, and they were asking me what to do in the community. We discussed, basically, resiliency and sustainability. This is different. We need to instead do planning differently and not planning as usual, which is usually the federal and state government coming into a local community and saying what they want to do. So I think that's different. We also have to look at the existing systems that react to emergencies locally. Is the incident command system, for example, the ICS, adaptable to change in emergencies? Can it be adapted to those climate changes? Slide 61 and 62, I won't read. These are just lists of adaptations that came from the Juneau Community Scientific Climate Change Commission. I'll go to the last slide. The last slide, I list things to think about and maybe leave with you. Expect change in the unpredictable. Identify the main drivers that make your community most resilient. That comes out of resilience theory and thinking. What are the energy, food, and culture things that drive your community? Identify the slow-moving variables, such as sea rise, which may be faster nowadays, ecological systematic changes, and other slow-moving variables. Ecological changes are unpredictable. expect that we do not, and for the foreseeable future, not be able to really understand the whole model. Storms and other weather systems will change and intensify, and the cues are changing. The different signals, look for different signals. We need new indicators for climate change that are sensitive to slow and fast-moving variables. Thank you very much. This concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Jim. At this time, we will pause briefly to take some questions, and we'll begin with those submitted online. And this is your final reminder that you can submit those questions online at any time by clicking on that question mark at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from Robert in Seattle, Washington. Robert asks, what educational strategies are you using with coastal property owners and communities?
Excellent question. I think that education is the key. We're not that advanced. I think it's a broad, rather than a local approach to climate change. There have just been, like the rest of the country, ICLEES, the organization that is helping communities around the world, they have presentation materials. Nothing specific, and nothing really specific about wetlands. Wetlands really isn't discussed. It's more social and infrastructure and those kind of things. So I can't offer any solutions, only to Google and look at what they're doing. I will say that the state webpage, the climate change, there's a climate, I think it's under quick links. Go to that, and that will give you updates as far as what communities in Alaska are doing and the state strategy and what the state agencies are doing. That's the state DEC webpage for Alaska.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Susanna in Oregon. Susanna asks, how do you perceive or how have you experienced the impacts that you described on and or the response of Native village communities?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't begin to even understand how they perceive their impacts. I think that you have to ask and you have to listen. For example, the consultants last night and the native from that community, Shishmaref, I asked them. And the question in rebuilding their community and moving their community caused by climate change, I asked them, what community do they want to create and how do they create a more resilient and sustainable community? I think the answers come from the native community. They don't come from the university, the state, or the federal government. The feds are reacting the way they used to, well, some, not all, and saying, you know, we will show up on such a date, and they come and they say this is what you should do, which is to build roads the same way, to build housing the same way. We need to do things differently, and we need to listen to the local elders of the communities, native and non-native.
Thank you. At this time, we'll address those questions over the phones. So just as a reminder, if you have a question, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question. Are there any questions from the phones?
Hi, this is Maria Goebel from New York City's DEP.
Go ahead.
My question is regarding the Lake Edge wetlands that have high incidence of global methane. I just was looking for some clarification. Is that as the lakes are expanding, the water is flooding those wetlands, which is releasing the methane, or I didn't really understand what he was getting at there.
It's caused by the thawing of the edge of the lake. That's occurring more rapidly than the thawing of the ice, and some of those ponds don't thaw at all. So that's where you're seeing most of the release. It's right at the edge. That's where the abundance of the peat and the bacterial processes are occurring. What was most surprising was five times more than we thought, and that's huge because of the effects of methane. As far as on the global, you know, balance of how much contribution we originally thought from methane. There's, I can't go into any more of the science than that. Walter, look at Walter, Katie Walter. Just Google her and climate change and you can get all the information you need.
Are there any other questions from the phone lines? If there are no further questions, we will move on to the final section of today's presentation. So at this time, David, if you could please unmute yourself and take it away. David, can you please unmute yourself? David, just use that code that we had practiced at the beginning of the phone call.
All right, now have you got me?
Yep, we got you.
Did it a minute ago. I guess I jumped the gun. My talk today is going to focus on a collaborative effort we have underway in New York's Hudson Valley to start implementing climate change adaptation strategies, really getting at challenges such as how do we actually achieve stronger wetland regulations. Before I kick into that, though, let me introduce you quickly to the Nature Conservancy. We are the world's largest environmental conservation organization. We have about 3,300 staff working in more than 30 countries around the world, and our mission is to protect the plants, animals, and ecosystems that make up the diversity of life on Earth. And although we've grown dramatically over the last 60 years, we actually started right here in New York's Hudson Valley, and our work is deeply rooted in local conservation. So we could drop to the next slide, number 76. My work on climate change started about 2 years ago when I was newly in this position with the Nature Conservancy. And I was canoeing through a wetland on the shore of the Hudson River estuary, about like this one, which is about 130 miles north of New York City. And the Hudson flows north-south and drains into New York Harbor. And it was a beautiful day. There were a couple of eagles that had flown overhead. I had 3-foot striped bass swimming under me. And I had gotten myself into some real trouble because I was trying to paddle out of the wetland and the tide was coming in, and it was a great and epic battle, but happily I was able to conquer nature and finally get back to my car. But when I was back at my car, I was struck once again at how powerful and persistent water is. And in particular, I started wondering how I was supposed to protect freshwater tidal wetlands like the one I had just been paddling in when they were likely to be under 2 to 4 feet of water in 100 years. And the Nature Conservancy is best known for our primary conservation tactic over the years has been to buy land. But what do we really accomplish by buying wetlands that are going to be underwater in 100 years? Let's go on to the next slide. One of the things I want to stress and staying with the theme of water here is that the Hudson River estuary is tidal 153 miles north of New York City. And basically what we have, the Hudson is about 310 miles long. And in its final, the final half of its journey, the river only drops 4 feet. And as a result, we have a 153-mile estuary where we've got the river pushing out and we have the ocean pushing in. And usually the salt water usually can only get about 30 to 40 miles up into the Hudson. On severe droughts, it can get farther north than that. But the tide of the 4 to 5 foot ripple of the tide goes all the way up to the headwaters, to the headwaters of the estuary, which is about 153 miles north of New York in Albany. And so what we have along the shores of the Hudson are these fantastic wetlands that are inundated twice daily but never taste salt. And they're one of my primary conservation foci. Moving on to the next slide. The sea level is rising because of climate change. We all know that. But the result is that we have to seriously rethink things. And one reality is that climate change is happening now. It's not something that's coming. And it's going to continue for the next 30 to 50 years, even if we stop our emissions tomorrow. As such, we need to confront climate change on two fronts, through mitigation and through adaptation. Mitigation is what most people talk about when they discuss climate change solutions. And mitigation is indeed critical because it will determine the scale of climate change's effects. For example, in New York, in a low-emission scenario, our climate is projected to become more like Virginia in 100 years, whereas in a high-emission scenario, it's projected to be more like Georgia's. So the result is that we need to pursue mitigation strategies, but climate change is happening, and the way our climate works in New York is going to be changing dramatically over the next 30 to 50 years regardless, and we have to adapt. And in the Hudson Valley, in the Northeast, we are seeing the likely impacts along three major lines. The first is sea level rise. The second is altered weather patterns, which will be characterized by more intense storms and droughts. And that's where we see the real impacts to both natural systems and to people. And then the third effect is, and this has been mentioned a couple of times, particularly by Virginia, the third effect is going to be the way that people respond to the first two challenges, because the way we respond will either abate the problems caused by climate change or they'll exacerbate them. Let's move on to the next slide. So adaptation is finally getting recognition now. I hear it in the news more, whereas 6 months ago people looked at me like I was an alien when I would talk about it in New York. But most of the talk on the adaptation front is about strategies. For example, for biodiversity conservation, everyone's talking about connectivity and migration corridors. And on the wetlands front, we're talking about stronger wetland regulations and more land protection. And these are great, but we've been talking about these strategies for decades, and we've been having a devil of a time actually accomplishing them. So the real question is, how are we actually supposed to accomplish these strategies? Because strategies without implementation, frankly, are just talk, 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 which we have way too much of already. Going on to the next slide. Implementation on climate change is hard for three primary reasons that I see. The first is that climate change is still viewed as an environmental and not a social problem, and any of you who have done any lobbying have a pretty clear sense that environmental topics, while people are concerned about them, they do not have a lot of political leverage. The second challenge is that most of the responses that are being proposed on a financial level, at least, are focused on mitigation and not adaptation. So we need to broaden the discussion to capture both halves of the climate change challenge. And finally, the public and decision makers want to know exactly what will be happening so they can make good decisions, but climate change is loaded with uncertainty, which is a fact that climate change deniers have used very effectively to their advantage over the last 10 to 20 years. Going to the next slide, we have...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if you wouldn't mind, could you please tell us the number slides that you are on?
I'm sorry, we're on 81 now. The header is Wetland Challenges, and there's a pretty shot of a fellow in a canoe. On slide 81, and I'm focusing on wetlands here because wetlands are the focus of my work, and their protection will, I think, be one of the core climate change strategies that we look at for infrastructure protection in the future. Wetlands are still viewed as an environmental issue, and in part because of this, there isn't a lot of cash for wetland protection, and there really isn't a lot of political will, at least not in New York, for stronger regulations. And just to give you a sense, in New York, we have a relatively weak state wetland protection law, and wetlands that are smaller than 9 football fields in New York are still fair game. Moving on to slide number 82. So how do we go from talk to action? In the New York Hudson Valley, the Nature Conservancy and a suite of partners are trying to use climate change as a catalyst for conservation. And I want to take a moment to identify our partners, because this truly is a collaborative effort. The Nature Conservancy is working very closely with the Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies, which is a world-renowned ecological research institution. We're working with two programs in the State Department of Environmental Conservation, the Hudson River Estuary Program and the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve. We're working with the New York State Water Resources Institute at Cornell University. And finally, we're working with a small but visionary nonprofit organization called Sustainable Hudson Valley. And this truly is an effort of all of these organizations, not just the Nature Conservancy. So let's roll into slide number 83. At the most basic level, our effort is shifting the perception of climate change from being an environmental issue to a social issue by highlighting the consequences of climate change on many different Hudson Valley interests. For example, this is a map of Beacon, New York, which is on the eastern shore of the Hudson, and it shows a wastewater treatment plant that will be inundated under under a major flood. Businesses and residents will be affected in the floodplains. Emergency first responders will be affected by climate change because they're the folks that are going to be going out into boats to rescue the people who are in flooded homes and businesses. Obviously, our roads, bridges, and railroads are going to be affected along with the natural systems. And I just realized that I'm pointing at the different things on my computer screen with my finger, which I'm sure is extremely helpful to all of you. So let's slide on to slide number 84. The Nature Conservancy and our partners are trying to shift this perception through a process called multi-stakeholder scenario planning, which is a mouthful, so I'm going to break it down into its two fundamental parts. The first half is multi-stakeholder, which for us has been the broad suite of interests that will be affected by climate change in the Hudson Valley. We spent initially several months building a list of more than 500 names representing more than 40 categories. And if you look at the categories, which I've presented here on the screen, you'll see that it goes way beyond the usual suite of enviros to identify a pretty broad sector, really the full suite of people living in the Hudson Valley. And then we spent several months actively recruiting folks to participate in the process. And when we were targeting participants, our goal was to get people from each category who could both inform the effort and who had enough authority in their companies and agencies and institutions to carry the conclusions that we collectively reach back into them to create change. Going on to slide 85, the second half of multi-stakeholder scenario planning is the scenario planning. And that scenario planning is basically just building a series of stories that can take the uncertainty and the vast scale of climate change and can translate them into something that different interests can think about productively. A common point of confusion around scenarios is that they are predictions of the future, and they're not. Scenarios are simply descriptions of potential futures that will help people do contingency planning and thinking. They are not models or predictions of what future conditions will be. That's an important distinction that I really want to underscore for the scientific folks out there. And as we drop to 86, you'll see two possible scenarios. These are basically 1 to 2 sentence blurbs describing two potential scenarios that we could be considering. We actually, our scenarios team, which is a small group of folks from the broader group of about 100 participants that are going to be getting together, we're going to be building 6 to 10 scenarios for initial consideration. And scenarios that we'll be building will have more detail than these two blurbs. And I suspect that the scenarios we build will represent a pretty broad range of potential impacts, from fairly mild to pretty serious. The two scenario blurbs that you see here are probably a little bit more on the severe side. But again, the goal is to generate scenarios that will stimulate thinking and will capture people's attention. After we build these 6 to 10 scenarios, we're going to go back to the full group of about 100 participants and cull through them and find the 2 to 4 that people find to be the most compelling and that are plausible to them. So the final scenarios we consider may not represent every potential future, but they'll represent a range of futures that people can use to think productively and in an innovative way about strategies in the future. So let's go on to slide number 87. Scenarios are just the foundation in the beginning of this process, though, and the key is to go from the stories to the implementation. That process has a few steps. The first is to take our final scenarios and to look at the likely impacts on each of the different interest groups. And then to consider the different responses that these different groups might take, the different strategies they might employ to protect themselves, and look at the, and to look at the ramification of those potential strategies. And this is important because the usual response to flooding, for example, is to build seawalls and levees. And it's pretty clear that in the Hudson Valley, no one wants to see the Hudson converted to a 153-mile culvert lined with 20 to 30-foot seawalls and levees. But that's usually the response that people take when they result when they respond to flooding in a quick and in a panicked mode. And so what we're trying to do is by working with all of these different interests together and identifying strategies to look beyond the short-term results of the strategies, but also to look at their ramifications and to look at the suite of options that we each might have to protect our particular interests. And as we go through that process, we'll find strategies that will benefit many different interests simultaneously. And I suspect that wetlands conservation will be one of the key benefits to come out of that process because the ecosystem services delivered by wetlands are vast and broad-ranging indeed, even if they're not broadly recognized by the folks that are benefiting from them. And then the final step is to implement the solutions, and that's the key because otherwise it's just talk. So we're a little ahead of strategy, we're a little ahead of schedule here, but that's all right. We're moving into the last slide, number 88, to touch on the benefits of this process. The first is that we're diversifying the concern about climate change and wetlands from an environmental issue into a social issue. And we're already seeing the results of this. At a recent talk I gave to a group of business leaders, the head of a county chamber of commerce came up to me and said, 2 to 3 feet of sea level rise, I'm going to start talking to our waterfront developers about this because that's going to have real impacts on our tax base. And we're getting an excellent response and participation from one of our local utility companies that are concerned about the impacts of climate change on their power lines and their power corridors and from the insurance industry. I'm very confident that wetland conservation will be a central strategy because of the benefits to so many interests. But the key here is that when you've got a lot of different interests that are all advocating for the same strategies, probably with very different motivations, but the same strategies nonetheless, we can build broad coalitions. And broad coalitions have much, much more political clout than the environmental groups do alone right now. Broad coalitions also have access to a much wider range of state and federal government dollars. Think transportation dollars, health dollars, even homeland security dollars, a much deeper pot of resources for climate change adaptation than we currently have just going into the environmental pot. And finally, when you combine more political clout with more dollars, then you can actually get implementation. And that's how I think that over the long term we can get stronger wetland regulations. We can get better regulations and incentives for companies to use best management practices for stormwater management, and we can get more resources for direct land protection in the Hudson Valley. So that's all I've got, and back to you, folks.
Thank you, David. We will again have time for some questions. However, let me first draw your attention to where you can obtain the contact information for all of our speakers today. If you're online, simply click on the Home button at the top of your screen. You'll be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has the speakers' email addresses and phone numbers. Please move to slide 90. Please take a few minutes and submit feedback to us on the webcast, and also please do check our links and additional resources. For those of you participating online, please take a look at the left-hand sidebar. There is a links button which has additional resources identified for today's webcast. Also on the left-hand sidebar, you should see a feedback button. Please take a quick minute or so to submit the online feedback form, as we really do value your comments as we strive to improve these webcasts. We will first address questions that are submitted online. Our first question comes from Alan in Texas. and Alan would like to know, of your stakeholders, which ones have been most responsive and active that are traditionally not engaged in environmental issues? What do you think is their motivation?
So far, the groups that we're seeing the most right now are county and regional planners, and I think their motivation is that this is a potential incentive to get folks to do better development practices. We're also seeing a good response from the insurance industry and the utility companies, in part because I think they're seeing the value of having more voices advocating for them. The groups that we haven't been able to tap as much as we would like are the business leaders. And we had a speaker from Goldman Sachs come to our first meeting, and he provided the beneficial insight that the business community isn't going to be interested likely in building the scenarios, but we will be able to get them more involved as we get into the actual scenarios and looking at strategies. Oh, also the marina and boat operators and boat clubs have been very involved.
And our next question comes from Robert in Seattle, Washington. And Robert asks, what kind of information are you using to construct the scenarios?
We have a climate change modeler from the Goddard Space Institute at Columbia University on board, and he'll be tapping into or providing us with access to a lot of different data layers and modeling. We're tapping into agricultural expertise, and we'll also be tapping into the general expertise of the different participants who are knowledgeable about their groups and strategies. And then there's a whole suite of climate change data that are out there that we're integrating in. The work by the Union of Concerned Scientists recently for the Northeast is a very useful tool.
And
but again, this is not prediction. This is stories that we use to describe potential futures.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ron in Connecticut. And Ron asks, on the subject of tidal rivers, the Connecticut River has extensive fresh and brackish tidal marshes and are designated as Ramsar wetlands. Sea level aside, it is expected that we should see major shifts in the salt wedge in the next 25 years as the snowpack to the north is replaced by rain. A diminished spring freshet should cause a shift in the fresh and brackish marked zones in the stream. Is a similar shift from reduced snowpack expected on the Hudson River?
I'm not sure. There's a fellow, Doug Burns, at the USGS, based in Troy, has done some very good research into that. I think basically what we're expecting in terms of the salt front on the Hudson is that we'll see more variability in where it is, with the Hudson having more intense flooding when we have larger storms, it'll get pushed farther south. But with the prediction of more protracted droughts, we are expecting to see it push farther to the north. And the city that's most concerned about this is in Poughkeepsie, which I think is about 70 miles up the Hudson from New York. And the city takes its drinking water from the Hudson, and if the salt front gets up to them, it could cause serious problems for their drinking water supplies.
Thank you. And we have one more question from online, and this question comes from Jason in South Carolina. As you mentioned, climate change is still viewed as an environmental, not a social problem. Has the shift that you reference of perspective in the Hudson Valley to collaboration include any grassroots environmental ed organizations or approaches, such as the ones employed by the Clearwater Hudson River Sloop?
It has not been one of our major foci. We've been working targeting primarily business groups. The Hudson Clearwater Sloop is doing some very exciting work in the low-income and disadvantaged communities along the Hudson, and that's a group of individuals that are going to also be really feeling the impact of climate change, because they're the folks often that can't afford the air conditioners and can't afford to get out of town to cooler places when you have heat island effects. So that hasn't been one of the foci of our groups at this stage, but it's an effort that could be very easily integrated into it.
Okay, and it looks like we actually have one more question from online, and this comes from Kathy in Colorado. Where are you getting the funding for your program?
We are getting funding for our program. We got a $20,000 grant from the State Department of Environmental Conservation's Hudson River Estuary Program, which is a fantastic program. We've gotten funding primarily, though, from a variety of private donors, and we have also gotten $50,000 from a NOAA grant as part of a broader shoreline hardening study. Overall, the whole project we're projecting is going to cost, because we are bringing in a very, very good multi-stakeholder scenario planning consultant, it's going to be running us around $300,000 over the course of about 18 months.
Great, thank you. At this time, we're going to address questions from the phone lines. So if you do have a question, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question. Are there any questions from the phones?
Yes, hi. Actually, this is Stafford Madison from the Wetlands Unit at the EPA in Boston. I have a question concerning actually the timetable for this whole project. Given the kind of broad spectrum of stakeholders that you've brought to the table, I'm just curious from the beginning, how long has it taken you to pull such a broad arena of folks together?
We've been working on it for about 6 months now, and it's an ongoing process. Our target is to have the whole process done by the end of this calendar year, and it's really the stages that come after this that I think are going to be most important. And we're not trying to get everyone who represents the different interests in the Valley at the meeting. We're just trying to get a few folks. But then we can go out and talk to, you know, if I can go out with the Department of Transportation and talk to town highway departments, I think I'll have much more credibility than if I'm just an environmentalist going in by myself. So we've been at it for about 6 months, but it's going to be a multi-year process.
Great, thank you.
If there are other questions from the phones regarding other sections of today's presentation, you're also welcome to ask those at this time. I just ask that the speakers could please identify themselves before they answer the questions. So is there another question from the phone line?
Yeah, this is Robert Wood at the Wetlands Division EPA headquarters, and this question is for David. You talked about the ecosystem services of wetlands being extensive, I think. You had some other adjectives there, too. But what I'm wondering is in your stakeholder interactions, are the ecosystem services of wetlands, I mean, just self-evident to the stakeholders? Are they accepting that particularly for infrastructure planning and protection, that those ecosystem services are obvious? Or if not, what do you do to sort of present that case and win them over?
I think that the individuals that are participating in the effort are predisposed to consider climate change as a challenge in wetlands conservation. So while it may not be something that's right on the front of their minds, they're already receptive to thinking about it. I think that more broadly, most people don't really think about wetlands as a way of decreasing the effects of major storms on bridge abutments. But if we can have people with credibility in those fields helping us go out and talk to those folks, it'll help speed up the education and acceptance process.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the phone lines?
Yes, this is Lindsay Adams in U.S. EPA headquarters. I had a question, and I know that you said that you were having difficulty in engagement from the business sector. So I was wondering, how are you reaching out to them and other stakeholders such as landowners and developers, and do you see the response increasing?
This is David Van Leeuwen from the Nature Conservancy. We are reaching out to them one lunch and one cup of coffee at a time. And our strategy is increasingly to try to find another partner who's in the business community or who is with a chamber of commerce or a regional development authority to reach out to them with us. And it's slow going, but it's moving forward. And really, the partner with the director of Sustainable Hudson Valley has been our real champion on that front.
And are there any other questions? If there are no further questions, this does conclude today's Watershed Academy webcast. On behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I would like to thank Dr. Virginia Burkett, Peter Slavinsky, Jim Powell, and David Van Leeuwen for all of their help with this webcast. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Megan Classic from the EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day, everyone.